Ekhatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge. Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are immersing ourselves in a source that explores probably the most dramatic boundary line in human experience, the one separating blinding genius from devastating madness. We are deep diving into Sylvia Nasar's masterful biography, A Beautiful Mind, the life story of the Nobel laureate and mathematician, John Forbes Nash Jr.
Yeah, and our mission for you today is really to give you the shortcut to understanding a life that was lived in three distinct, almost unbelievable acts. We're not just exploring mathematical theorems here. We're kind of confronting this profound quotient of resilience.
Right.
What happens when one of the 20th century's most purely rational minds is completely shattered by an irrational, all-consuming mental illness? In this case, paranoid schizophrenia.
It's truly the ultimate nonlinear narrative, isn't it? Because the story doesn't just stop with the tragic descent.
No, not at all.
It's a powerful testament to the enduring possibility of recovery, redemption, and maybe the fierce strength of human connection. I mean, if you've only seen the Hollywood movie, you should get ready, because Nasar's book is far more complex, much more sobering, and ultimately, I think, more inspiring.
Indeed. It's a heavy book, no doubt, but an essential one.
Yeah.
Because it forces us to discard that sort of romanticized idea of the mad genius.
Yeah, that trope.
Exactly. And replace it with the challenging reality of what it actually means to reclaim your identity after decades of, well, profound loss.
So let's unpack the person who documented this extraordinary life. Sylvia Nasar herself is a deeply interesting figure, which is, I think, crucial to the book's authority.
Definitely.
She is an accomplished journalist, a writer, and importantly, she has a strong background in economics.
And that background is really the engine of the book's credibility, wouldn't you say? She spent significant time as an economic correspondent for the New York Times. This was 91 to 99, and she held a position at Columbia University.
Right.
A pure biographer might, you know, focus only on the drama, but Nasar had the technical savvy to truly grasp the monumental impact of Nash's work, particularly the game theory stuff.
And that combination of skills, economic literacy, paired with, like, serious journalistic rigor, that's what sets the book apart. She didn't just tell a good story. She fact-checked a ghost, almost.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
Yeah.
She conducted exhaustive research, interviewing hundreds of sources, family, colleagues, professionals, and because she could treat his mental illness with the same factual seriousness as she treated his theorems.
Which is key.
Absolutely key. She was able to paint a complete, honest picture of the man, not the myth. She wasn't just observing the genius, she kind of understood the mechanics of his specific genius.
Okay, so if we look at the overall architecture of the biography, Nasar's central purpose was what? To provide an unvarnished, holistic account of Nash's life, really correcting those myths that tend to build up around both brilliance and suffering.
Yeah, exactly. The book is structured almost like a classical tragedy that leads to this improbable triumph. We begin with the meteoric rise through institutions like Carnegie Tech and then Princeton, what she calls the Olympus of American intellects.
Mm-hmm.
His early 20s saw the creation of the revolutionary Nash equilibrium, which just cemented him as a major figure right out of the gate.
Then Act Two, the tragic turning point, the catastrophic onset of paranoid schizophrenia around age 30. This led to decades of institutionalization and, well, intellectual silence.
Just lost years. And then Act Three, which is perhaps the most moving part of the story, the long arc of redemption and this astonishing recovery, which culminated incredibly with him receiving the 1994 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences.
Wow.
It's a powerful narrative about how success and even life itself can be so nonlinear.
Okay, let's deep dive into the specifics now, starting with the prodigy in part one. He was, as you said, a solitary, socially awkward figure growing up in Bluefield, West Virginia. Apparently, his genius wasn't always obvious to others.
Not at all. It manifested in these flashes of otherworldly insight that kind of separated him entirely from his peers. He was just different.
And the defining moment comes when he arrives at Princeton's Fine Hall in 1948. You mentioned it was like Olympus, a legendary, intimidating environment.
Totally. And despite his, arrogance and his incredibly strange social behavior, Nash quickly established himself by developing the foundational ideas for his doctoral thesis on non-cooperative games. Just blew people away.
And this is where the Nash equilibrium comes in. Now, for our listener who might not be a mathematician or economist, why did this concept change the world? What is it, basically?
Well, it's brilliant in its simplicity, actually. Before Nash, economics often relied heavily on Adam Smith's idea, you know, the invisible hand, that if everyone acts in their own self-interest, the best outcome for the group is achieved.
Right, the classic idea.
Nash proved mathematically that this isn't always true, especially in strategic interactions where what one person does affects the others.
Okay, so the Nash equilibrium is like the mathematical framework for finding a stable state in a competitive situation, where no single player can do better just by changing their own strategy, assuming everyone else stays put.
Precisely. Think of an arms race, or even like a simple traffic jam. Everyone acts in their own perceived best interest, trying to get ahead, but the result is often suboptimal for the group, stuck in traffic.
Right.
Nash provided the mathematical tools to understand those complex dynamics. That's why his work became central to everything from economics and military strategy, even evolutionary biology. It just cemented him at the peak of his early intellectual power.
So from that peak, we move into The Hidden Life, Part 2. Professionally, he's thriving MIT, consulting for the RAND Corporation on Cold War strategy, really high-level stuff.
Yeah, top-secret clearance, the works.
But his private world was becoming incredibly chaotic and sort of compartmentalized.
You really see the seeds of the later breakdown here. There was the intense secret relationship with a nurse, Eleanor Steer. She bore his son, John David.
A child, Nash. Tragically and largely abandoned, right?
Yes, and Nisardoz doesn't shy away from the ethical complexity of that. It's quite stark. Then there were the clandestine homosexual relationships, which ultimately cost him his security clearance at RAND. A huge blow.
She really shows us this paradox, doesn't she? A genius who could master the universe of mathematics, but failed spectacularly in the universe of basic human connection, or at least responsibility.
She presents it warts and all, as they say. It really speaks to the growing instability inside him. Then he married Alicia Lard, a brilliant physics student from El Salvador.
Right, Alicia.
And while their marriage seemed to promise stability, it was fragile. Ultimately, it just couldn't withstand the psychological storm that was brewing inside him.
And that storm breaks completely in The Descent, Part 3. Around 1959, his eccentricities suddenly metastasize into full-blown paranoid schizophrenia. He's only 30 years old.
Yeah, just 30. And the specifics of his delusions are heartbreaking because they sort of mimic the language of his genius. He started believing he was receiving coded messages from extraterrestrials hidden in the New York Times.
Wow.
And that men wearing red ties were secret communists conspiring against him. A mind designed to find profound patterns began finding terrifying, non-existent ones everywhere.
What's so devastating is that Nazar shows his genius didn't protect him. In some ways, it almost amplified the illness because the delusions felt to him like legitimate intellectual discoveries.
Exactly. He actually told people that the ideas he had about supernatural beings came to him with the same conviction, the same feeling as his mathematical ideas.
That's chilling.
It is. This inability to filter what was relevant insight from what was just noise, irrelevant noise, is classic schizophrenia, and it just shattered his world. The book also details the harrowing medical reality of the era, specifically the brutal insulin coma therapy.
Yeah, maybe we should quickly contextualize that for listeners. Insulin coma therapy involved injecting massive doses of insulin to induce a deep coma, sometimes involving convulsions. It was incredibly dangerous, really barbaric by today's standards, but used extensively back then.
It was a desperate measure for a desperate time. And this period then transitions into The Phantom, Part 4. The nearly three decades of lost years. Just years of wandering, repeated institutionalization at places like Trenton State Hospital, and deep intellectual silence.
He became this tragic legend at Princeton, didn't he? The silent, ghost-like figure scribbling cryptic numerological formulas on blackboards in Fine Hall. They called him the Phantom of Fine Hall.
That's right. But this section also highlights the quiet hero of the story, Alicia Lard. She actually divorced him in 1963, which is understandable given the circumstances.
Yeah, of course.
But then she made this extraordinary decision in 1970 to allow her ex-husband to live with her again. Not as a husband, but as a kind of non-pressured, stable boarder.
That's just a staggering act of loyalty and compassion. It provided the only stable anchor in his entire life during that period, an environment where he could simply exist without judgment or expectation.
Absolutely. And that environment was arguably essential for his eventual recovery. Which brings us to The Resurrection, Part V. Starting sometime in the 1980s, the remission began slow, quiet, almost miraculous.
And the key is how Nazar explains why it might have happened, right? It wasn't just medication or standard therapy.
No, it seems to have been a combination of factors. the stability Alicia provided, the quiet tolerance of the Princeton community, and crucially, something unique to Nash, his own self-directed recovery effort.
He described it almost like an intellectual act to reject the delusional thinking.
Yeah, he essentially treated his illness like a faulty mathematical premise or maybe like a bad diet he needed to stop feeding. He consciously chose to starve those irrational thoughts of his attention, applying rational scrutiny to them.
He used the same cognitive machinery that created the Nash equilibrium to dismantle his own delusions.
Yeah.
That's an incredible mental feat.
It really is. And of course, the book culminates with the profound symbolism of the 1994 Nobel Prize. It validated not just his genius, but his return. It transformed him from a tragic myth back into a living, relevant person.
Amazing. Okay, let's pivot now to the core takeaways beyond just the timeline. If you pull back from the narrative, what are the key messages about the human condition that Nassar leaves us with?
Well, the first, and I think the most important, is dismantling that stereotype, the devastating reality of mental illness. Nassar shows schizophrenia not as some quirky source of creativity, but as a cruel neurological disease that steals identity and function.
And that forces us, as readers, to view the patient, and maybe the caregiver, with immense respect for their courage, which brings us right to unconditional love and sacrifice. Alicia's loyalty, it was enduring, pragmatic, fierce.
Her journey completely reframes our idea of love, doesn't it? It wasn't a fairy tale romance. It was the sustained, pragmatic compassion. Her decision to take him back in, knowing the hardships, was like the invisible pillar that held his life together.
A third key theme, one that maybe gets overlooked sometimes, is the power of a supportive community. You mentioned the Princeton community providing this quiet, tolerant sanctuary. They allowed him to wander the halls, scribbling on boards, without judgment.
Yeah, and that's a powerful lesson. Support doesn't always have to be active intervention or therapy. Sometimes just acceptance, allowing someone to simply be without pressure to conform or achieve, is the most healing environment you can possibly provide.
And finally, there is that theme of redemption and second chances. His life just proves that decades can be lost to illness or crisis without that being the end of the story. Success and life itself is fundamentally nonlinear.
Absolutely. It's a powerful challenge to that sort of American idea that you must be peaking in your 20s and 30s. Nash teaches us that a life can be reclaimed truly at any age.
The book is just filled with moments that crystallize the painful complexity of Nash's mind. Let's look at a few key ideas or quotes. The first one, paraphrased from Nash himself, explains his confusion. The ideas I had about supernatural beings came to me the same way that my mathematical ideas did, so I took them seriously.
That quote provides probably the most profound insight into the connection, maybe the confusion, between his genius and his illness. Both felt like genuine intuitive discoveries to him, arriving with the same profound sense of conviction. Imagine the terror of being unable to trust your own cognitive faculty, your greatest asset.
Chilling. Another powerful idea, this one paraphrased from a colleague, reflects the impact of his Nobel recognition. The Nobel Prize didn't just give him an award, it gave him his life back. It made him real again.
Yeah, that just encapsulates the symbolic power of the Nobel so well. It wasn't about the money or even the prestige in the usual sense. It restored his identity and dignity after decades of being defined primarily by his sickness.
And we have to return to that concept you mentioned earlier. Nash's eventual recovery was a conscious intellectual act. He chose to apply that rational mind, the same one that defined equilibrium, to starve the delusions of his attention.
It's an incredible, almost unique form of healing agency. It speaks volumes about the power and the mystery of his particular mind.
So, what do we do with this knowledge? How can we maybe apply the lessons of a beautiful mind in our own lives, in our communities?
Well, application one is simply deepening empathy. By seeing schizophrenia through Nash's rigorously documented experience, we're encouraged to see the person behind the illness. Maybe the next time you encounter someone suffering from severe mental illness, try to view their actions as neurological symptoms, not moral failures. Be patient, like Alicia was.
That's a big one. And application two could be valuing neurodiversity and eccentricity. Nash was objectively a very strange, difficult person even before his illness manifested fully. The book prompts us to consider where that line between unusual perspective and pathology truly lies.
Right. It reminds us to maybe create a bit more space for unconventional thinkers. Unique, even eccentric, perspectives are often the source of groundbreaking innovation, whether in the sciences or the arts. We need to tolerate the friction that sometimes comes with profound originality.
And finally, as we touched upon, the enduring lesson of resilience in crisis. His story just demolishes the myth of the smooth, uninterrupted career trajectory.
Yeah. So if you, the listener, are going through a personal or professional crisis, maybe remember Nash. Your ultimate worth isn't defined solely by your period of highest productivity. A life can be reclaimed, and maybe the greatest accomplishments still lie decades ahead.
What surprised me most about this deep dive, I think, was the sheer rigor of Nasr's refusal to simplify him. The complexity of a mind that can both perceive these profound, elegant patterns in the universe and terrifying non-existent ones. It truly redefined for me what genius and maybe what recovery actually looks like.
Yeah, for me, the final thought is just a profound appreciation for those invisible pillars that held Nash's life together. The ferocious, unassuming loyalty of Alicia, the quiet tolerance of that very specific Princeton community, and ultimately the almost unbelievable will of the man himself to reclaim his own mind. The book is just a lasting lesson on human potential and simultaneously human frailty.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.